This is a recording of a sermon given at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.
Good morning. So I looked in the mirror this morning and I said to myself, Tiffany, in the last 10 days, the Supreme Court has ruled that Texas does not have to offer license plates with the Confederate flag on them, ruled in favor of affordable housing, ruled in favor of the Affordable Care Act, and ruled in favor of gay marriage. And in less than 2 hours, you get to stand up in front of a group of people who cheered louder and louder with each of those rulings. No pressure. For as long as I can remember, my mom, when questioned about any plans to get together with her friends, would remark, "I only have three friends." This was her way of avoiding crowded events, of which she never was a fan, while also unintentionally conveying her ever-present and somewhat bothersome feeling of insignificance. I knew what she meant. At any given time in her life, my mother had three people she permitted into her inner circle. The individuals themselves changed as they and my mother moved through the different stages of life. In high school, it was Chuck, Marty, and Carol. In her early 30s, it was Kathy, Jesse, and Jody. In her 40s, it was Jesse, Sarah, and Deetra. And at the end of her life, it was Jesse, Deetra, and Chuck. These are people I have called aunt, uncle, teacher, friend. All of them brought into my life through their connection with my mother. From each of these people, I have learned important lessons about tolerance, about family, about supporting those you love. But neither my worldview nor the experiences that have made me who I am today are limited to these people. We say it in the seventh principle that we are all connected in this interdependent web of existence. But I don't think we always notice how connected we are. With people, we often refer to it as 6 degrees of separation. Just a few examples. One of my PetSmart training clients works at a dental practice with my cousin. Our storyteller today, Lynn Murphy, attends Elliott Chapel with my friend and coworker, Linda. One of my best friends from high school is an anesthesiologist at Mercy, where he often shares an OR with our own council chair, Mark Bruins. Our connections are everywhere, and like a spider web, are not linear, but are connected in multiple places. As many of us know, St. Louis is kind of like Mayberry. Eventually, you're going to meet someone who knows someone who turns out to be a neighbor, coworker, or cousin. But here's a tale that better illustrates my point. My high school anatomy teacher, upon hearing my college choice, said, "Oh, one of my son's friends goes there." Now, this would not have been surprising if I had been attending a local school or even a large but relatively close one. But I ended up 750 miles away at a tiny school in northern Wisconsin. And sure enough, I ran into this common connection my freshman year. But when you only have 19 St. Louisans in a school, you are bound to find each other. It's everywhere else that no one's ever heard of my alma mater. So imagine my surprise, then, to spend one Sunday morning ushering with Gene Rubin and learning that his daughter was getting ready to marry the son of my college chemistry professor. But wait, hold on. There's more. Another morning, I ushered with Carol Ray. Carol hired me as an intern for the St. Louis Zoo one summer during college. The following year, I returned as a counselor for the Camp Kangaroo program, which I found out later was a connection I shared with my sister-in-law. Evidence of our connections with others is everywhere, and the wider your lens, the more filaments you see of the web of existence. When my mom started working for Barnes Jewish Hospital's HR department, one of her fellow newbie co-workers was named Keith. Mom came home from her first day and she said, "Oh, Tiff, you have to meet this guy. He's got a weird sense of humor just like you." So I couldn't pass that up, and the first time I met Keith, I told him my favorite joke, which I'm happy to share with you now. A duck walks into a bar, goes up to the bartender and says, "Got any grapes?" And the bartender looks at him and says, "No, this is a bar. Go away." And the duck waddles out. Duck comes in the next day, goes up to the bartender and says, "Got any grapes?" The bartender says, "Again, no, get." Duck waddles out. Duck comes back in the next day. "Got any grapes?" The bartender says, "Look, This is a bar. We've never had any grapes, never going to have any grapes, and if you come in here asking for grapes again, I'm going to nail your little web feet to the floor. The duck runs out. Duck comes in the next day, goes up to the bartender and says, "Got any nails?" "No." "Got any grapes?" Keith fell in love with this joke, and according to his coworkers, told it to every single person that joined their department for more than 10 years. A quick Facebook check earlier this week confirms no fewer than a dozen people who still remember the joke, the punchline, and most importantly, their fond memories of Keith. And I smile to think that I played a part in that. Now, I'm certainly not suggesting that I'm the focal point or even a focal point of this web, but I'm a part, and so are you. In spite of where we have come from, where we are now, where we are going, no matter how we identify ourselves within the spectrum of humanity, we are dependent on and related to each other in more ways than are evident at first glance. And we underestimate how our actions can affect those around us, both in the moment and in the future. In 2001, I was 19, home from my freshman year of college and interning at a fisheries lab near Flora, Illinois. It's also somewhere no one's ever heard of. Coming home from St. Louis the first weekend in July, I had my first ever flat tire. So there I am, heading to meet my folks for dinner, dressed in a long skirt and heels, standing outside my car on a hot summer day. I was familiar with how the whole tire-changing thing was supposed to work, but I had never had to do it on the side of the highway. Before I even had time to freak out, a car pulls up in front of me, and out get three people, two men and a woman, all wearing jumpsuits. They looked at the tire, looked at me, and asked if they could help. And then, and here's the part that had the greatest impact on me at that time in my life, the woman changed my tire, while one man kept an eye on traffic and the other one chatted with me. Their license plate said Idaho, so I asked how they ended up in, you know, middle of nowhere, Illinois. And he laughed and said, "Actually, they're from California. They were in town for the VP fair. They're pilots and were flying in the air show." Years later, another flat tire found me in much the same position, skirt, heels, whole shebang. But rather than fretting about calling AAA or my husband at the time, I thought back to this woman, brought into my life by coincidence, by good timing, by whatever you choose to call it, and my faith in myself and my abilities were restored. I had the tire changed before any passersby had the opportunity to ask if I needed help, and I didn't even run my pantyhose. One Sunday this April, I found myself downstairs as the greeter for our service. A little girl came in with two stuffed animals clutched in her hands, one a turtle and one a tortoise. I knelt down and I asked her about her fluffy friends, and I mentioned, as I have more times than I can recount, the difference between tortoises who have walking feet and turtles who have swimming feet. Shortly thereafter, I was up here at the pulpit discussing the work being done to fill our open board and council positions, made a quick reference to the fact that I had worked at the St. Louis Zoo, finished my announcement, went back downstairs to my station. After service, a church member I had never met before came up to me and told me a story. His mother had passed away the week before, and although he wasn't really feeling up to being around a bunch of people, he had come to church this morning and walked in the door at the time I was discussing turtles and tortoises. His mother, he explained, had volunteered at the zoo for years, and he had, for years, heard her explain walking feet and swimming feet, just like I did. Hearing me say it, followed by hearing that I too had worked at the zoo, brought him some feeling of comfort. But it doesn't end there. During our chat, I explained that I too had lost my mother recently, and we shared a bit about the grieving process. I had also been having an off day, but I had come to church partly to fulfill my greeter and announcer duties, partly because I knew in my heart that it would help me somehow. And it did. Sharing our experiences of loss, of adjustment to our new normal, helped both of us. 10 years from now, that little girl probably won't remember the lady at church talking about her testudinal friends, but I will remember the interaction and the healing that it led to. And although the little girl probably won't remember me, as adults, it's our job to guide and teach our children. As they say, little pitchers have big ears. And sometimes as adults, we underestimate the effect our actions have on children. When I was in my tween years, my dad and stepmom lived in Springfield, Missouri. My stepmom's employer at the time had a family discount rate for Silver Dollar City. So one summer day, we headed to the amusement park for a day of fun. Standing in line that sunny day, my brother and I paid little attention to what was going on at the ticket window until my dad asked us to go sit on a bench nearby. It wasn't until later that I found out it was because the woman selling tickets could not fathom that my stepmom's discount applied to all of us, because she is black, so obviously we couldn't be family. Think about that for a moment. In 1966, interracial marriage was illegal, or at the least restricted. This changed in 1967 with the Supreme Court's unanimous decision that such prohibitions were unconstitutional in the famed Loving versus Virginia case. In the early 1990s, interracial marriage was legal, but favored by less than 50% of the Americans surveyed in a Gallup poll. In 2013, that number was 87%. The adult side of my personality tells me that's progress to be proud of. But the little girl sitting on a bench outside Silver Dollar City 20-some years ago tells me that it's not good enough. Our actions and interactions are like a stone dropped into a still pond. What we see as a simple act, releasing something as small as a pebble, can have far-reaching impacts beyond our intention or imagining. 2 years after Loving versus Virginia, and 46 years ago today, hundreds of pebbles dropped in a pond in New York created ripples and waves that we are riding today. The introduction to PBS's American Experience documentary, Stonewall Uprising, explains. In the early morning hours of June 28, 1969, police raided the Stonewall Inn, a popular gay bar in the Greenwich Village section of New York City. Such raids were not unusual in the late 60s, an era when homosexual sex was illegal in every state but Illinois. That night, however, the street erupted into violent protests and demonstrations that lasted for the next 6 days. The Stonewall Riots, as they came to be known, marked a major turning point in the modern gay civil rights movement in the United States and around the world. In the late 1960s, the American Psychiatric Association still classified homosexuality as a mental disorder, and gay men and lesbian women received almost universal moral condemnation from mainstream religions. The act of homosexual sex, even in private homes, was punishable by a light fine, 20 years in prison, or a life sentence. New York City had the largest gay population in the United States. It was also the city that most aggressively upheld anti-sodomy laws. In the mid-1960s, New York created police vice squads to raid gay bars and baths and began using decoys to solicit and entrap gays. By 1966, over 100 men a week were arrested as a result of this effort. The Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights continues the story. Police reinforcements arrived and beat the crowd away, but the next night the crowd returned, even larger than the night before, with numbers reaching over 1,000. For hours, protesters rioted outside the Stonewall Inn until the police sent in a riot control squad to disperse the crowd. For days following, demonstrations of varying intensity took place throughout the city. In the wake of the riots, intense discussions about civil rights were held among New York's LGBT people, which led to the formation of various advocacy groups, such as the short-lived Gay Liberation Front, which was the first group to use the word gay in its name, and a citywide newspaper called Gay. On the first anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, so 45 years ago today, the first gay pride parades in U.S. history took place in Los Angeles, Chicago, San Francisco, and near the Stonewall Inn in New York. The Stonewall Riots inspired LGBT people throughout the country to organize in support of gay rights, and within 2 years after the riots, gay rights groups had been started in nearly every major city in the United States. Think on that. In 1966, homosexuality was not only illegal, it was classified as a mental disorder. It was something wrong, something miswired, something to be treated with psychotherapy, medication, even shock therapy. 2 days ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the U.S. Constitution requires states to license and recognize same-sex marriages, making, as President Obama said on Twitter, a big step in our march toward equality. Though my favorite was Jill Biden, Dr. Jill Biden, who posted on Twitter that Joe had a rainbow flag around his neck like a cape and was running up and down the halls of the Capitol building. And yet, as Loving versus Virginia proved, there is a glaring difference between what is legal and what is accepted in public. In 2015, Gallup tells us that only 60% of Americans support same-sex marriage. Given the history of the topic, this is surely progress to be proud of. But it's still not good enough, and so we must continue to march. Today, after the service, many of those here will head downtown to march in the St. Louis Pride Parade. For many of those marching, it is a simple act, a date marked on their calendar where they march to show support and solidarity with the LGBTQIA community. They don't do it for recognition, for a pat on the back, for any reason other than they believe it is the right thing to do, to support their fellow human beings, to reaffirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person, to promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, to stand up and say, I care. To these people, marching is simply a part of their day-to-day, a pebble dropped into a pond. But what about the ripples their actions create? What effect might this show of support have on the teen questioning their sexuality, wondering if something is wrong with them, if they are or are not normal? What effect will this demonstration have on the parents supporting their child who has come out as gay while facing the stigma that is somehow their fault? What effect will it have on someone who believes internally that civil rights are human rights, but who's not sure how to translate that belief into action? To me, being a part of a church that encourages acceptance of differences and active protection of everyone's rights has moved me from a position of donating to causes and voting for laws, from someone who walked away from negative conversations as my way of showing disagreement, to someone who will speak up and say, that is not right, that is not equitable, and I will not be silenced in the face of intolerance. Finding my voice in this sacred space allows me to support others as they support me, as we each discover and develop our own faith. It encourages me, as I encourage you, to drop a pebble into a pond and watch the ripples radiate from it. And when we each drop our pebbles into this lake we call existence, how quickly we find that our ripples connect with, intersect with, and combine with those of our fellow human beings. Now, my physics major friends, will explain that when waves of equal frequency and phase connect, the result is mutual reinforcement and increased amplitude. When our ripples combine with those of others, moving the same direction toward the same goal, they naturally combine to build on and reinforce each other. In this way, our individual ripples combine to form waves, currents, and tides capable of wearing down and washing away the harsh, rocky cliffs of intolerance and injustice. Now, I've told a few people that when Thomas mentioned a few weeks ago that a speaker was needed for today's service, my mouth moved faster than my brain. This is not uncommon. And I said, oh, I can do that. Then I found out it was Pride service, and then SCOTUS ruling. So again, no pressure. It wasn't because of an unquenchable desire to relive my junior year public speaking class, or a belief that I could, in 1 hour, present a service capable of changing minds or having some overwhelming effect on those in attendance, especially in light of all the exciting news coming out of the Supreme Court. It was because this church and its members have moved me with its ripples, have provided me with the opportunity to clarify and nurture my beliefs. As my mother did, I have 3 close friends at this time in my life. I have Joan, who's like a big sister to me. I have Kelly, who's like my little sister. And I have Amy, who shifts from one to the other depending on the situation. All have helped me on my journey through life. With these women, I have shared joy and grief, humor, support, and too many calls, text messages, and meals to count. I have 3 friends, but in this church and its congregation, I have a community, a family, and an entire ocean full of the ripples and waves of my fellow human beings.
You have been listening to a sermon recorded at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.